Welcome to Justice Visions, a podcast about everything new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Centre of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to this new episode of Justice Visions, where today we'll talk about the Philippines, because in May 2022, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., better known as Bongbong Marcos, and the son of the former dictator Marcos, won the presidential elections. Moreover, the vice presidential elections were won by Sara Duterte, and she is the daughter of former authoritarian president Rodrigo Duterte. So in today's episode, we'll talk about what to make of this if we look at it through the lens of transitional justice. And Tina, you just returned from fieldwork in the Philippines, so maybe you would want to start by just describing the historical context for our listeners who might not be familiar with it.
So Ferdinand Marcos Sr., that is, like many dictators, he came through power through democratic elections. But then in 1972, he declared martial law. So that has basically been the beginning of a 14-year one-man rule, which lasted until 1986, when he was ousted by the EDSA People Power Revolution. And then he was exiled, the whole family actually was exiled to Hawaii. And so during that period, that martial law period, of course, there were extensive and massive economic crimes, fraud, cronyism. So the Marcoses have been proven to have embezzled, to have misappropriated billions of public funds for their personal benefits, channeling all the money to offshore bank accounts, etc. But then, of course, there was also the suspension of civil rights. The state took over many media channels, opposition members got arrested, political opponents were targeted, and more generally, there were really gross human rights violations. So 3,000 people have been documented to have been killed through extrajudicial killings, that is. There's 35,000 documented cases of torture, 70,000 documented cases of incarceration. What's striking about the Philippines is that disappearances amounted to around 1,600. And that, I think, is relevant to mention, is relatively low in absolute numbers if you compare it to some other dictatorships at the time. And some would argue that that was precisely because of the scare tactics of the Marcos regime, where rather than disappearing people, there were salvagings. So people's tortured, mutilated, their maimed bodies would actually be left or even displayed in the street as a warning for others. So it was a very brutal dictatorship.
And of course, to link this back to the main themes and goals of transitional justice, the return to power of the Marcoses raises obvious questions, not in the least regarding the aim of non-recurrence.
I mean, that's very true, because this seems like one of the most obvious instances of recurrence, right? The son of the former dictator now returning to power to the presidential office. A couple of things are really striking from that point of view of TJ and especially of non-recurrence. And the first is, of course, that what we see is that during his electoral campaign, Bongbong Marcos, or BBM, as he's popularly referred to, he himself actually already very kind of explicitly tried to make that distinction between him as a Marcos returning to power, which he tried to argue was not at all the same as a return to human rights violations or economic crimes, etc. So he had his rhetoric going on saying, you know, I'm not my father, give me a chance, look at my track record, look at my policy, that kind of thing. And so he's really aware of those connotations of his name, trying to distance himself from that relation with human rights and economic crimes. Now, of course, the other thing is that for someone with that name to at all be elected to that office, I think it's clear that quite a bit of historical revisionism has been happening. And that's what we've been seeing for the past 10 years, that there has really been a systematic campaign, mostly, of course, below the radar, of the Marcos family to weigh on the public discourse, to recast the historical narrative about the Marcos era, about the martial law era, erasing the crimes and the human rights violations from public discourse.
Right. And the martial law era, which you just mentioned, and which ended in 1986 when Marcos was ousted, this is really interesting, because then Cory Aquino becomes president and she starts a transitional justice process. Is this correct?
Well, Yes and no, because as you just mentioned, this is 1986, right? So this is before, let's say, the poster children of transitional justice. It's before the South African transitional justice process. It's before the fall of many Latin American dictatorships. And so, yeah, it's true. We see a range of initiatives that you could logically label transitional justice. There's a constitutional reform process. There's vetting procedures, very contested ones, though. There's attempts at reforming the police and the military, again, with relatively little success. But there's also then some initiatives in the domain of truth, memorialization. But by and large, the language of transitional justice is missing, just because it's not mainstream yet at that point, I think, to use that overarching framework. Their comprehensive approach that we now call transitional justice just isn't so mainstream yet. And so initiatives are a bit more dispersed, a bit more ad hoc, if you will.
And would you argue that the lack of an overarching framework of transitional justice would result in a fragmented process of dealing with that legacy of violence?
Yeah, I think to some extent it does. You could say it does, because there's also, of course, the political reality, which is that the presidency of Cory Aquino was a very unstable one. She was under constant threat from the military which had played a very ambivalent role both during the martial law era, but then also toppling the Marcos dictatorship. And so there were several attempted coups. There was, I think, six, or depending on how you count, but very little room for her really to seek accountability in that situation, where a lot of members of the old regime and a lot of the generals and military commanders too were still in place. And so there's that fact. But then there's also the fact that civil society, it's pretty much exhausted after 14 years of dictatorship and after the People Power Revolution. Or some of my interviews, for example, said we were exhausted, but at the same time, we were also on a high. We were assuming that democracy would just kind of take care of itself, that it would just be this, you know, kind of linear progress, that achievements wouldn't be turned back. Of course, looking at the situation today, yeah, things are a bit more uncertain. And that's a story that you hear from many activists, is that there was so much confidence in this idea of linear progress that maybe not enough attention has been paid to truth processes, to memorialization, to cementing that collective historical narrative about the dictatorship that would be difficult to undermine. It seemed so obvious that these crimes would always be remembered.
But there have been some initiatives, right? And we will be talking about some of those today.
I think today it's interesting to look at two really kind of state-sanctioned formal initiatives, because two really stand out. So we'll be talking about, on the one hand, the Presidential Commission on Good Governance. The Presidential Commission on Good Governance was established immediately after the fall of the dictatorship. So it was one of the first acts of Cory Aquino. It wasn't exactly a truth commission, but it did have a mandate to go after the ill-gotten wealth of the Marcoses and to establish what had happened in terms of fiscal fraud, in terms of economic crimes. And it also, to some extent, engaged in outreach on that topic. So there was an obvious truth I mentioned there. And then the other state-sanctioned initiative, which is really important, is the Human Rights Violations Victims Memorial Commission, more commonly known as the MEMCOM or the Memorial Commission. That initiative is a much more recent one. It was established in 2013, so about 30 years after the fall of the dictatorship, and it was an attempt to really kind of offer recognition and reparations to victims of the dictatorship and to also cement that public narrative at that point.
And to zoom in on the first initiative, you talked with Ruben Carranza, who is currently a senior expert on reparations at the International Center for Transitional Justice. He was also a commissioner on the Presidential Commission on Good Governance between 2001 and 2004. Let's listen to that interview.
The PCGG was a post-dictatorship revolution commission. Initially, the idea in 1986, after the Marcos dictatorship fell, was to create one big commission for both human rights violations of the dictatorship and corruption by the dictatorship. But the political leaders at that time who discussed this thought it would have been too broad a mandate. So they split the big commission into two, one for human rights violations and then another for corruption and recovering ill-gotten wealth from the Marcoses. So the PCGG was created separately from the Presidential Commission on Human Rights, and the PCGG was given the mandate to recover ill-gotten assets, work with prosecutors to prosecute the Marcoses and their cronies, both in the Philippines and in other countries, including in Switzerland.
But the PCGG, with its focus on economic crimes, was in many ways unique in the transitional justice landscape, no? Because it had to kind of plot its own course of action. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about what you think its main contributions to the TJ process have been, or maybe also what it could have done differently.
You're right. And the two important things about the PCGG was how organic it was, that there was no precedent that could be found at that time in terms of creating a post-dictatorship commission to specifically go after the dictator and his cronies. And the second aspect of this was that the PCGG had a truth-seeking power as well. So it wasn't just to litigate and recover assets, but it could actually find out why the dictator was able to amass so much ill-gotten wealth and then report about that to the Filipino people. Of course, many other things could have been done better by the PCGG. The things that it could have done better would have been to decide and prioritize which cases to go after first. But instead, the PCGG went after most of the biggest cronies. And initially, it worked, but eventually, it succumbed to the dysfunction of Philippine politics, the corruption that was still entrenched in society.
So would you say that the PCGG's focus on economic crimes led to blind spot for human rights violations perpetrated by the Marcos regime, especially with the Presidential Commission on Human Rights ceasing to exist and before it could submit its final report?
I think the initial problem with having the PCGG continue to exist, but there was no corresponding PCHR, there was no corresponding commission to go after human rights violators, was perception, first of all, that the dictator was accountable for economic crimes and corruption, but apparently human rights violations were less important and perhaps postponable in a way, as far as perception was concerned, which was, of course, not true. But it also led to a larger problem, which was the fact that the Philippine military and police were never subjected to accountability, were never reformed in a way that was far-reaching and deep, with no one going after them. They felt that they could even have more power and as much impunity as they wanted, which today still exists. That was the initial problem. The later problem was for transitional justice, not just in the Philippines, but elsewhere in the world. The perception that you could have transitional justice that focuses only on one aspect of violations, but not another. And this problem, I think, continues to affect the way we design transitional justice mechanisms, although there has been some level of acceptance now that many of these violations do take place and do happen simultaneously and perhaps should be addressed concurrently.
One attempt at addressing some of the blind spots of this initial transitional justice process, I think, was the Republic Act 10368, which you were also involved in drafting. And I wanted to ask you why that was such an important piece of legislation and why did it only materialize in 2013?
I think it's partly because transitional justice in the Philippines became so focused on going after the Marcoses where they were, which was in this case the United States, that there was no large strategy, there was no comprehensive design for transitional justice in the Philippines. And so over the years, these were just fragmented efforts and no attempt at consolidating them so that it was both strange and perhaps inevitable that it was only when we recovered ill-gotten assets from the Marcoses that there was enough momentum and literal capital to design a reparations program, but that required a reparations law. The fact that it took another 10 years after I first drafted the reparations bill in 2003, it was only passed as a law in 2013, that delay was precisely a consequence of not having a transitional justice strategy. You allowed the Marcoses to build enough power to resist, and over time, the longer it took, the more power they recovered. So recovering ill-gotten wealth was what I was doing, what we were doing, but the Marcoses were recovering power as well.
So an important element of that reparation bill, of course, was the establishment of the Memorial Commission, which we'll talk about more in this episode. But I wanted to ask, was that a reaction to the initial absence of a formal truth commission or an institutionalized memorialization effort?
I'll answer that question from a very personal perspective. When I was drafting the bill, I incorporated what I have described as a backdoor truth-seeking process into the reparations process. In other words, I wanted the reparations institution to be created by the law to actually hold public hearings, to actually give opportunities to victims who came forward seeking reparations to also do truth-telling in public if they wanted. The final law actually gave them the authority to conduct hearings, which in the end they never did, and they said it was for lack of time and lack of capacity to do so. But there was that possibility. I called it backdoor truth-telling because had it been front-door truth-telling, the Marcoses and their cronies would have fought so hard that the whole law would never have been passed. It would have been killed outright. So you insert it at the back, see if they notice it, and they did not. But at the same time, there was a front-door effort, which was the Memorialization Commission. And to me, I felt that they would not resist it as much because it was explicitly backward-looking. In other words, it wasn't going to build the basis for criminal prosecution or for further asset recovery. It was memorialization. The idea, at least on the surface, was that people would recall the past rather than go after them in the future. But I think it was also, and this was not intentional, I think it also became the memorialization part, as we see now, has become one of the most important legacies of the law. Even during the return to power of the Marcoses, that there is that possibility that even after they try to erase the history of the dictatorship, you will still have an official basis to recall the past and maybe even to pursue accountability.
Maybe to take a leap forward, looking at the current political situation in the Philippines, which element from the TJ toolkit, or maybe even which approach to TJ, do you feel holds the most potential for ensuring non-recurrence or further violence or human rights violations?
That's difficult to answer. And I think part of the difficulty is the fact that the Marcoses have had a long period of time to plan how they would fight back, plan how they would revise history, amass the resources they need to do that. On the other hand, you have Filipino activists and whatever institutions that remain, the MEMCOM is one of them, just trying to survive. So memorialization will be important for mobilizing younger people who are confused by the historical revisionism being done by the Marcoses, but not entirely convinced by it.
What strikes me most is how much time was needed for that reparation bill to be passed effectively.
Yeah, it's right. And of course, that means that the number of claims that were filed, on the one hand, of course, it's only the tip of the iceberg, but also all of those claims that were submitted, which is, I think, over 75,000, of those 75,000, only 11,103 were granted reparations. I think that's still massive. You know, it's highly significant. And if you think about it, that means that over 11,000 people were still capable, sometimes more than 30 years after violations took place, to submit affidavits with the required forensic evidence to back up their story. So in that sense, of course, it's a huge number. As Ruben mentioned, even if it's only the tip of the iceberg, these victims, they are formally acknowledged by the state. There are cases where the state has recognized that, yes, human rights violations have taken place under the Marcos dictatorship, and that cannot be taken back. And in this current era of fake news and of disinformation and of historical revisionism, I think that number is hugely important as an unshakable reference.
Yes, and it also goes back to the point about how that history of violence is remembered, and also to the memorialization component of the law, because testimonies of victims were not only collected in the context of monetary reparation orders, but the idea was also to use these as the backbone for memorialization efforts. And you talked about this issue with Chuck Crisanto, who is the director of the MEMCOM. Let's listen to how he describes the work of this Human Rights Violations Victims Memorial Commission, as it's called officially.
So Jack, as the director of the MEMCOM, you're in charge of building the Freedom Memorial Museum. And for a while, that seemed like a tricky endeavor because you had the files in your archive. The design for the museum had been selected, but funds were not being released. And so just a few weeks ago, that changed. The budget has now been signed. It has been approved by the president, and the work on the construction of the museum can now start. So congratulations for that. But for this interview, I was wondering if you could first maybe tell us a bit more about how you have been approaching memorialization in your work up until a few weeks ago, when it was still uncertain whether that physical structure would at all become a reality.
Even before the physical museum is to be built, the Memorial Commission has engaged in human rights education programs. And in this regard, we have tried to reach to our audiences in different platforms. And the audience we're trying to reach are the young people. So we are on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok, on YouTube, as well as on our website, which has proved to be beneficial due to the lockdown, wherein the entire public sector did not distribute textbooks. And so the fight or the battle for memory was in the internet. In this regard, the Memorial Commission also ran Wikipedia editathons in our battle for memory, so that resources and references of students or scholars who want to look at what happened during that period can readily log in and see some of our material online.
Right, and I think this move to social media platforms, it's really interesting because the Philippines has a very young population, which of course, because of that reason, mostly has no firsthand experience of the martial law era. It's very interesting how you try to address that problem by trying to activate young people themselves to engage with, to share these truths, for example, by organizing TikTok battles and competitions. And we'll link to some of those in the show notes, because I think it's really inspiring also for other people to see how you can use social media for memorialization work. But the other thing that I wanted to ask you about are the educational materials that you just mentioned. Because of course, since 2016, there's been a lot of controversy about the new approach to teaching materials about martial law history. So how is that situation today? And do you engage in that debate as the director of the MEMCOM?
The Vice President, Sara Duterte, who sits as the Secretary of the Department of Education, recently, in the last month or so, came out with a public pronouncement describing what she was doing in the early 80s. And she says that at that time, she was so busy in order to support her grandmother. Her grandmother, Nanay Suling, as we fondly call her, led the Yellow Friday movement in Davao City in protest against a dictator.
Quickly, for our international speakers that might not be familiar with the context, this might be news that actually the grandmother of currently Sara Duterte and the mother of Rodrigo Duterte, she was a movement leader against the Marcos dictatorship. And so you say that Sara recently referenced her resistance activities in a public pronouncement, right?
That pronouncement, which she let out, gives us hope that she's open and that she will allow us, the Memorial Commission, to have a partnership with the Curriculum Development Bureau, who is in charge of developing material for all public textbooks. We tried in the last administration, but we never made any headway in that regard. Perhaps this year, we may see some changes. After the president won in the May 2022 elections, there was fear that even my commission, the Memorial Commission, would be obliterated. Now in 2023, facing the new year, President Bongbong Marcos did not obliterate our agency.
It is quite striking here that this optimism and creativity in making sure that something happens is very present. You have the TikTok challenges or the way to mobilize the legacy of Soledad Duterte.
Yeah, and I think it's a kind of creative energy that you observe among many members of civil society. At the same time, of course, many people are really tired. Some activists even use the word PTSD after the Marcos's return to the presidential balance. They've been so shocked and depressed by that reality. But at yeah, there's also so much resilience, so many smaller initiatives. For example, in the domain of arts, museums, curators, all engaging with and trying to navigate that reality, that difficult political context, that shrinking space.
Yeah, this is hugely important because for now we have only been talking about those two state-sponsored initiatives.
Yeah, true. We could do a mini-series on this as well because we've indeed only talked about these state initiatives, but a lot exists beyond or in parallel to, or quite often also, frankly, of course, in opposition to government. And so many artists, for example, are really creating work, engaging with the various dimensions of this historical violence, artists trying to destabilize that narrative that people are fed 20 times per hour through social media, no, that tries to leave as little room as possible for doubt. And so galleries, museums, they're curating exhibitions, universities are organizing documentary and movie screenings just to still kind of try and destabilize that narrative.
So you would say that today there exists a vibrant landscape of memorialization?
I would at least say that it's more and more vibrant. On the one hand, before May 2022, so before the presidential elections under Duterte, I think everyone was just so focused on the extrajudicial killings and the violence that took place in the context of Duterte's hyper-violent war on drugs. And there was so little room for anything else, right? And then at the same time, with that electoral campaign, the re-election of Bongbong Marcos, it became blatantly clear how far historical revisionism had been going, had gone already. So I think these two combined, the end of Duterte and then the start actually of the in-your-face nature of the Marcos historical revisionism, I think that really pushed activism in the domain of truth and memory regarding the martial law period to the top of many activists' agendas, yeah.
And we'll also link to a piece that Rappler, the Nobel Peace Prize winning newspaper from the Philippines, did on this issue of misinformation.
Yeah, it's hugely interesting. And just quickly for our listeners who have noticed this, it's also, of course, great news that just recently the verdict came in that Maria Ressa, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, has won the court case against her allegedly for fiscal fraud. So that's a bit of positive news here.
Yeah, that's wonderful indeed. And for now, I'd maybe like to wrap up our episode and ask you the question that we normally ask of all of our interviewees, because you've been just traveling there and you've been doing a lot of field work in the Philippines. Where are you looking for inspiration and which evolutions do you see that you find promising for the future of transitional justice?
One of the interesting things that I've been observing is how some form of standardization and really having that overarching discourse of TJ is important. And the reason I'm saying that is that, of course, in the past decade, there have been so many critiques of standardized transitional justice as being too legalistic, too stodgy, too institutionalized, you know, too much of a blueprint, all of that. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I've been part of that critique, but I think the Philippines is a case that shows the merit of actually having that standardized overarching framework, because there it wasn't there, and it led to a very fragmented approach. And at the same time, I think that another thing that the case shows is that a lot of innovation, a lot of contextualization of I don't know, bricolage, if you will, is still possible and important even within that standardized framework. So for example, what Ruben was saying about the focus on economic crimes, about, you know, getting that backdoor truth-telling and sneaked in there. So that is one thing, the place of standardization. The other thing I think is really relevant to mention is that I think often when we talk about truth, there's this almost implicit assumption that the mere fact of truth-seeking or truth-telling will in some way mean that those difficult truths will find their way into society, into public discourse, and will affect society. And that, of course, is an assumption that really needs to be unpacked. What we see here is that if people are constantly fed the same disinformation, for example, through social media about what happened under Marcos, just getting the truth out there, so to speak, doesn't dent those beliefs automatically. So I think we need much more research on how these truths are received in society. And there I think that, for example, the artistic practices that we only touched upon now, they really offer us interesting ways to think about ways of impact that we could explore further.
Wonderful, Tine. Thank you. That sounds a promising research area indeed. And we'll be sharing some of those examples that you just mentioned in our show notes for our listeners. And I would like to thank you for this conversation. And also thank our interviewees, Ruben and Chuck. And of course, thanks to our listeners. We'll be back next month with a new episode.
Thank you.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website justicevisions.org or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.
End of Duterte, and then the start actually of the in-your-face nature of the Marcos historical revisionism, I think that really pushed activism in the domain of truth and memory regarding the martial law period to the top of many activists' agendas, yeah.
And we'll also link to a piece that Rappler, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning newspaper from the Philippines, did on this issue of misinformation.
Yeah, it's hugely interesting. And just quickly for our listeners who have noticed this, it's also, of course, great news that just recently the verdict came in that Maria Ressa, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, has won the court case against her allegedly for fiscal fraud. So that's a bit of positive news here.
Yeah, that's wonderful indeed. And for now, I'd maybe like to wrap up our episode and ask you the question that we normally ask of all of our interviewees, because you've been just traveling there and you've been doing a lot of field work in the Philippines. Where are you looking for inspiration, and which evolutions do you see that you find promising for the future of transitional justice?
One of the interesting things that I've been observing is how some form of standardization and really having that overarching discourse of TJ is important. And the reason I'm saying that is that, of course, in the past decade, there have been so many critiques of standardized transitional justice as being too legalistic, too stodgy, too institutionalized, you know, too much of a blueprint, all of that. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I've been part of that critique, but I think the Philippines is a case that shows the merit of actually having that standardized overarching framework, because there it wasn't there, and it led to a very fragmented approach. And at the same time, I think that another thing that the case shows is that a lot of innovation, a lot of contextualization of I don't know, bricolage, if you will, is still possible and important even within that standardized framework. So for example, what Ruben was saying about the focus on economic crimes, about, you know, getting that backdoor truth-telling and sneaked in there. So that is one thing, the place of standardization. The other thing I think is really relevant to mention is that I think often in transitional justice, when we talk about truth, there's this almost implicit assumption that the mere fact of truth-seeking or truth-telling will in some way mean that those difficult truths will find their way into society, into public discourse, and will affect society. And that, of course, is an assumption that really needs to be unpacked. People's cognitive and affective frameworks aren't that easily destabilized, right? And so this is something I think where what we see here is that if people are constantly fed the same information, disinformation, for example, through social media about what happened under Marcos, just getting the truth out there, so to speak, doesn't dent those beliefs automatically. So I think we need much more research on how these truths are received in society. And there I think that, for example, the artistic practices that we only touched upon now, they really offer us interesting ways to think about ways of impact that we could explore further.
Wonderful, Tina. Thank you. That sounds a promising research area indeed. And we'll be sharing some of those examples that you just mentioned in our show notes for our listeners. And I would like to thank you for this conversation, and also thank our interviewees, Ruben and Chuck. And of course, thanks to our listeners. We'll be back next month with a new episode.
Thank you.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.